Here's Chris Mayer, host of SFM 93 Live.
All right, what is up, everybody? Welcome back to the program. Very, very excited for today, tonight's episode, episode 21 of FFM 93 Live. A lot of stuff to talk about with the current Flyers. Also, Dave Pullen will be joining me. We taped that interview yesterday morning at 10 a.m. It was a lot of fun. There's a lot of good stuff in there. It was very good. Pullen's a very, very good speaker, very good just interviewee. He's very, very good at you know, just TV and all that stuff too. You can kind of see that as well. But so basically the way this will go will be Pullen will join. So I'll play that here in a minute. And then we'll talk about the last couple of games for the Flyers. We last left off in episode 20. The Flyers were kind of in a weird spot. You know, that you won a couple of games. You know, we previewed the Capitals game, which didn't really go so well. But you know, for the most part, you know, I think a good amount of stuff was you know, in that episode was still similar to now. The Flyers are still having similar issues, not as, you know, not scoring, things like that. They did get Van Riemsdyk back, and, you know, which I talked about in the last episode. He came back that night, the day after against the Capitals, and he's played really well. I also have a couple updates for myself and Philly Hockey Now, but we got a couple more people trickling in here. What's up, everybody? Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Yeah, let's not waste any more time. And here he is, everybody. Here is Dave Pullen, former Flyers captain, just Philadelphia Flyer great, Dave Pullen. All right, what is up, everybody? Welcome here to the podcast. Very, very excited for this interview. I've been planning to actually get Mr. Pullen or Dave here for a handful of weeks now. Dave Pullen, former Flyer, former Flyers captain, now works in media with TSN. Dave, thanks so much for doing this. I really do appreciate it. I'm really, really excited to talk with you today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Chris. It's been a busy fall for me. So in my hybrid of jobs, I work in arguably six or seven different silos. And so one of my, I guess the first silo is I do the Toronto Maple Leaf panels between periods and intermissions. So for the TSN games. The second one is Montreal Canadiens color. And then the third and fourth ones are the Ottawa Senators and the Winnipeg Jets. And they can be either color or in-studio panels between periods or in those buildings. And so November, the way it fell out just happened to be a really busy month. I know we've been trying to hook up for a little while, but it did involve two trips to Philadelphia. I was in with the Ottawa Senators on a Saturday afternoon early in November.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I was in for 80s night as well.
Okay.
At the end of the month. So yeah, it's great to see everybody. Great to be back in Philadelphia. Always fun to come back. But then in addition to those things, I also do Gino Retta's show, That's Hockey.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do some SportsCenter work. And then I do quite a bit of radio. I do Ottawa radio regularly, Winnipeg, Toronto. And so our four regionals are those cities plus Ottawa. And I do a lot of radio stuff. And I've added writing to the whole package this year or a couple years ago. And I write on Sundays in the Toronto Star. So check that out too. I write fun little columns and and like I needed another challenge, Chris, so I decided to try writing.
Right. No, for sure. And you know, it's funny because I feel like there's a lot of guys like you, you know, played and coached and all that stuff, and then kind of go right into the media stuff. And seems like you're obviously, you know, pretty busy with, you know, and it's good too because you're, you know, you're keeping up with the league and everything else and all that stuff. So
yeah, you have no choice. It's kind of like being in school, Chris. If you do your work all the time, then you never have to work. And like being in school or staying in shape or whatever, if you pay attention in your course from day one and do the work every day, then when the finals roll around, it's like, yeah, it's just another day. Right. And that's the way I feel. And, you know, when I go on to do games, to do, and I do follow the league closely. Obviously, the teams that, because your team is playing against someone, and I'm in the buildings quite a bit, like I'll see 50 games live this year total. So, and in all across North America and all, right, I get right. in all the buildings and see them. So it works out very well.
No, for sure. And especially because you're, you know, really busy with that stuff too. But, you know, kind of just going back to your like early career, like how did you kind of get into hockey? You know, that's one thing I always love asking guys is, you know, how did you actually get into the game first and then kind of going from there?
I grew up in a town about 600 miles north of Toronto. And Timmins, Ontario. And so obviously, as soon as I tell you that, you're going to say cold weather, good outdoor ice. And we always joke that Santa Claus had to come north to get to Timmins instead of south from the North Pole. We had better outdoor ice than Santa Claus did. But I was a figure skater up there. I wasn't a hockey player. And I started off figure skating. I figure skated till I was 9 years old and actually skated with a female. We had a little Paris thing, who ended up, you know, skating the Canadian Championships. She was quite a skater. And so that's how it all started. And then when I moved to Toronto, then it transferred into hockey. Then I went out and tried out for my first team. I started at House League, kind of worked my way up. And when I was about 11, 12 years old, I connected with these two kids. And the left wing was kind of a rough and tumble kid, you know, and you could say that about a 12-year-old. And the right winger was highly skilled. So we'd have met when we were 11. Steve Craig and Eddie Howell. And Eddie was really skilled. He was the most talented player on the line. I was kind of the middleman. Steve was the rough and tumble guy. So we went up from House League to B-level rep to A-level rep to AA as a line. And stayed together for the better part of 5 years. But I was really small, Chris, and each year I'd be the last guy to make the team, and then I'd lead the league in scoring, and then they'd say, well, you did it at Pee Wee, but you can't do it at, you know, minor Bantam. And anyway, worked my way all the way up. And then when I was 16 years old, I backed off. And it's an unusual story because I went back and played house league with my buddies. Just hockey wasn't fun for me anymore. And you know, it sounds crazy to this day when you're 16 years old. Now, most kids are top prospects, but I backed off. And I went back and played house league with my buddies and really rediscovered my love of the game. Played a year and a half with them down there and then went back. And I'd grown a little bit and my game started to track together. And so we had 5 years of high school in Canada at that point. I took a year off after the fifth year. I was ahead in school. And just more or less dedicated myself. I played 1 year of tier two junior. And then everything connected for me. My size, my speed, my game, it all connected that year. And that's when the college scholarships started to roll in.
Right. No, for sure. And you know, it's funny, like when I originally, when we landed this and when I was, you know, looking up, you know, questions to ask and stuff, like your career, the way you got into the league, it's fascinating to me because, you know, all the time, you know, you see the draft and all these guys playing and, you know, the CHL, the Q, the OHL, college, whatever. And you played college in Notre Dame for 4 years. And from what I understand, you didn't really get any call or anything like that. I guess really had no understanding of maybe what you would do. And if, at least for pro hockey, like, did you ever think that you would play pro hockey after college, or was it more of just like
it wasn't kind of taking it? Aim, Chris. Yeah, it wasn't the aim. It was to get a good education. I had a number of scholarship offers. You were allowed 6 trips at the time, and so I went to Notre Dame first. And no one in my family had a formal education past high school, so nobody knew the system. Nobody knew anything about it. So I went to Notre Dame first. And I narrowed down, I had about, probably 20 scholarship offers and narrowed it down and picked 6 schools. So I went back to my high school guidance counselor and showed him this list of ridiculous schools, you know, like Princeton, Harvard, Cornell, you know, Yale, Michigan, Michigan State, Notre Dame. And he's looking at this list of schools and he's saying, are you kidding me? And I said, no, I can go pretty much anywhere I want to. And so we picked three in the Midwest and three in the East. Excuse me. And I went to Notre Dame first. It was a freezing cold Saturday in January, and I was jamming it in amongst my games. And I got on campus, and it was magical. And the basketball team, actually, that was the year they went to the Final Four. And they were playing a Saturday afternoon game against North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I walked through a dormitory, and every door was open. And the roars were going up by basket scored or the groans of shots missed. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is what kids do about sports in college. Mm-hmm. And then I went to two games that weekend, Friday night and Saturday night. And just, I called home Saturday morning. I said to my dad, I'm going to Notre Dame. I'm not even taking the other five visits. And I didn't take the other five visits, much to the chagrin of the other coaches. But I wanted to go where I could combine education and athletics. And mm-hmm. to me, Notre Dame was the best place. And I had a great freshman year. And there was actually talk about whether I would leave after my freshman year. And I had not been drafted. And I was squeezed a little bit between the 20-year-old and 18-year-old draft in 78. When the WHA merged with the NHL, they changed the draft year from 20 to 18. And so 3 years got compressed into one. And then they went from 12 rounds to 6 rounds. And the Flyers maximized that. And they got some great free agents out of that timing. Timmy Kerr came out of that group. Ron Flockhart mm-hmm. came out of that group. So when you see guys not drafted, it was a little misleading because they combined three draft years into one. So I went back my sophomore year and got very sick my sophomore year, and it carried into my junior year. I got meningitis. And so it set me back physically. I played, but I wasn't healthy. And so it was my senior year when everything came together for me in college. I did have some opportunities coming right out of my senior year to go to join an American Hockey League team. During spring break, I chose not to. I was going to go to work. And then I had, you know, post-graduation was when the pro side happened, because I had an opportunity. Ted Sater, who went on to be a Flyers assistant coach and a head coach in the NHL, was coaching in Sweden at the time. Mm-hmm. He offered me in June to go over just for a year. And he said, we need an import. We lost our import late. Would you be interested? And so in all, you know, in this crazy world we live in, it all crisscrossed there, and I ended up going to Sweden, and that's where, again, I talk about next levels. That's where Ted Sater was able to help me sort of fine-tune my game, worked on some of the individual things I needed to work on, and it led back to an opportunity with the Flyers.
Right, you know, for sure, and you know, just going off of that, like, you know, Ted Sater, obviously, he was a huge importance to you. You know, is there anything that you can kind of speak of him to how important, you know, he was to you in your career? Because, you know, if you didn't have him, you know, probably wouldn't even make the NHL.
No, there's no question. And he was all about skill development, which is the NHL now, but this is 1982.
Right.
And we would take a day each week and we'd have jump ropes on the ice. We'd have all these different, you know, things like accessories, and he'd be trying all these different things. We'd move station to station. He was quite ahead of his time in terms of training. But what he did more than anything, Chris, was he brought out an individual element in my game. And up to that point, I'd probably been a pass first, always, you know, looking to make a play kind of player. He stressed to me, look, you've got to lead the league in goals. And I said, Ted, I've never led any league in goals that I've played in. And when you're an import over there, there's only two imports allowed on the team at that point. So you were brought in pure offense, like forget backchecking, forget assists. They wanted goals. And so I guess I just put more focus on that, started to shoot the puck, and started to think of myself more as an individual creator than I was just a passer. And it rounded out my game in a nice manner. I think I had 35
and 32.
32, which is crazy. I mean, a goal a game for a player like me. And when you're targeted, I was playing in Division I over there. And so every game, I was the big gun on the other side.
Right.
So I was the one they game planned for. And so it just brought out another part of my game that arguably I didn't even know I had, Chris.
Right, exactly. And just going off of the stats and things like that, like you were when you were with the Flyers, I mean, obviously plus minus is a stat, and obviously now you're working in media, it's a stat that can kind of get overlooked a little bit, but you were plus, not just plus like two or three, like you were plus like 31, 43, 20, 47, 17. Like those are really high numbers. And especially, in an era that you played in, which was, kind of just like you said, which wasn't a lot of skill development and all that stuff. Was that like, I guess, like defensive style that you had, which was like good defensive forward, but also could score and put up 30 goals, kind of like you mentioned. If I were to compare it to a Flyer now, I'd probably say closest, probably Sean Couturier, up there in
Yeah,
Selke voting.
I'd be flattered for you to say that. I think Sean came up arguably as a more offensive player than I was coming up through the ranks, and rounded out his game maybe a little bit of the reverse of what I did, whereas my offense grew, his defense grew.
Right.
But that would be the type of player. I got in a Selke conversation early and was matched up against the other team's best players. But, early on, I was the de facto number one center on the Flyers, starting my second year, I would say. But that was just because that was the need. And, once they put me with Timmy Kerr and Brian Propp, I'm playing with the two best offensive players in the team. So I'm the number one center. I didn't have number one center skills. And I say this, humbly, when we lost to the Oilers in 1985, their second line center was a guy named Marc Messier. The first line center was pretty good too. He wore number 99. And so when we lost that year, you're thinking, okay, like humbly speaking, we've got to get better offensive centers in here because, if I'm the number one guy here and there's two guys wearing 99 and 11 on the other side, we don't have enough offense to win. And really when Pelle Eklund came in and Peter Zezel to a point as well, they took some of that offensive load and then I shifted a little more to the defensive side, although I still played with Timmy and Propp.
No, for sure. And was that kind of like a big thing for you that year? I know you dealt with some stuff in 85
as
well. Yeah,
I dealt with ribs primarily. I had a knee in 85, and then I banged up some ribs against Quebec. In 87, I broke ribs in the first round and sort of played through. But everybody was banged up at that point.
The
dear departed Brad McCrimmon in 85. We lost in that series with a shoulder. And we didn't have a healthy Tim Kerr. And I would have loved in 87 to have had a healthy Tim Kerr. I think he was, everybody was banged up. We played 26 games in 53 nights that year, Chris.
That's a lot.
It's crazy to think of going back and forth in flights. And, you're going back and forth in the West every second day to Edmonton. It's just, it's attrition. And we weren't able to stay. And we played a hard game as well. Part of our being banged up, and we played hard.
Right, no, for sure. And I feel like you see that now in the NHL too. Like the Flyers right now, for I think it was maybe 40 days or so, and right now that they're still in the middle of it. They're playing like 21 games in 40 days, basically not having like one day over, one day more of like being off. Basically, you play, you're off a day, and then you play again. And it's crazy, with all the schedule condensing and things like that, but kind of you mentioned Quebec a little bit. Take me through the 5-on-3 shorthanded goal. That's probably one of the most famous Flyers goals that I have seen. Probably one of the more famous goals in your career as well.
It's the one I'm asked about the most, Chris. Yeah. There's no question about it. In fact, I have a picture behind me that someone took and got to me, and it's a picture from the second balcony. Excuse me, right above the net where it's shooting down just as I shoot the puck. So someone with an old-fashioned camera sitting up there snapping a picture and managed to get it to me. Yeah. And I've got it in a little frame, and it's one of the things I treasure. So in that series, we're up 1-0 at that point, and we're riding Pelle Lindbergh. Lindbergh had just been fantastic through the playoffs. And we're up 3-2. And I had broken two ribs on a shorthanded goal situation. Murray Craven scored a shorthanded goal against Quebec in game two. And on the play, Mario Marois had managed to fracture two of my ribs with a cross check. And I remember celebrating the goal. and just I was just writhing in pain, thinking, okay, this is not good. And so I'm not even sure I got through that game. And then we won game three, lost game four, and now this is game five back in Quebec. I played, and now it's game six at home. So we're up 3-2. We're up 1-0 in the game, and it's the second period, and the 5-on-3 situation. They kept collapsing lower and lower because of their frustration. They couldn't figure out how to score on Pelé Lindbergh. Mm-hmm. So it went from circle to circle, and I just jumped the pass. And
right,
talk about a long breakaway. I mean, talk about a long breakaway, Chris. That's a long skate.
That's like the whole ice. That's basically from the other dot all the way down to the net.
It was. And Mario Gosselin in net, the guys had always been saying, you got to go top shelf, you got to go top shelf. And I wasn't a great shooter. And I could hear Murray Craven's voice in my head ringing to this day, you got to go top shelf. And so I got it right where I wanted it, underneath the bar. And I remember as I circled around, there's only two of the guys on the ice, Chris. There's not a lot of guys to celebrate with. And I was like, I had, you know, my standard celebration was one arm up in the air. And I think Mark Howe got to me first, and then Doug Crossman was the second player on the ice. And one of the sweeter celebrations. And it was the impact. As much as that goal was, it was an individual play on the goal, but it was going to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Right,
that made it 2-0. We added a goal
in that game, too. It's such a deflator. You know, you're 5-on-3, you're thinking, well, this is a prime opportunity to score, and you get a shorthanded breakaway for 3/4 of the ice.
Yeah, it's a 2-goal swing.
Right.
It really is. Or maybe a 3-goal swing, because they're, you know, they might be looking to score, too, in their situation. So,
right.
But the sweetness for that was that we were going to the Stanley Cup Finals for the first time.
Right, exactly. You know, you mentioned Pelle Lindbergh a little bit. What did PF stand for with Pelle?
Personal friend. Personal friend. It wasn't Philadelphia Flyer.
Mm-hmm.
And he always signed off like that. I always signed off like that. We had a unique bond. You know, me having spent a year in Sweden, I picked up a little bit of the language. And
yeah, I was going to ask if you learned about any Sweden.
I was fine in hockey Swedish at that point. You know, Herger and Vestra left and right, and you knew enough to get by. And so we had our little Swedish thing going. And so the interesting thing about Pelle was he was at his best in a competitive situation, which he didn't consider practice to be a competitive situation. Mm. So I would personally... Chris, if you saw me score a goal on Pelle Lindbergh, I would celebrate like a madman in practice to try and make him mad, to try and get him to try harder. So we did have a special friendship, and you know, it was a loss of a dear friend and a great teammate.
Yeah, it's crazy because I've never seen, you know, I'm only 19, so I haven't, you know, obviously grew up in different era, but everybody that talks about the 80s and you know, the Flyers, and it's Lindbergh, it's you yourself and Tim Kerr and everybody. How much do you think that era of Flyers hockey, those handful of years when he's, you know, went to the finals and, you know, couldn't bring it home, but how much do you think that kind of brought the fan base together and, you know, had everybody kind of around the Flyers up until that point?
Well, let's tie it to the current day situation, Chris, because our challenge was, as a young team, everybody wanted the Broad Street Bullies back. They didn't want us. I mean, you know, the legend of Bob Clark had retired. Billy Barber was just retiring. Rick McLeish had gone through those final teams. And they had had so much success in the mid-70s. And that's what our fans wanted. They didn't want us. And we had to win them over. And, you know, we weren't the Broad Street Bullies. We had our toughness and we had our elements, and certainly Rick Tocchet and Dave Brown and, you know, Glenn Cochran and Daryl Stanley were both part of that mix. We were a tough group. We weren't the Broad Street Bullies. And we weren't the guys that had won two cups for that city and that had changed, you know, the whole sort of tone of hockey through those days, and particularly the pride with which the city of Philadelphia adopted them and identified with them. And we weren't that. And we had to win them over as a bunch of kids. And that's what we were. We were that year in 80-45, we were the youngest team in pro sports. And if you go back, HockeyDB is a great website because you can go back to 80-45 and you could look at the team and then you could see the exact age of the players in that year.
Right.
And so you look at the 19s and 20s and 21s on that team. It's crazy. I mean, when we started the year, Zezel and Smith were both 19. Tockett was 20. The Twins were 20, Ronnie and Richie. Reid Craven was 20, 21. It was just a whole bunch of kids. And so I think we captured the spirit of it. And the challenge that the Flyers have today is similar to the challenge that the 80s team had. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that the team that went to the finals in the late 90s had, the Lindros team, and the team that went to the finals in 2010 had. The past is so strong, the tradition is so strong that that's what people want. But they have to adopt today's team and to almost that, relabel right. it, re-identify it. They do, and it's a hard challenge, Chris. It really is.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, especially because, you know, when the team in the past handful of years, a really strong year a couple years ago, and then it's just really dropped off. But I'm curious. I got a note from someone about the bridge toll prank at the Walt Whitman Bridge. Can you explain that a little bit?
I can. Greg Smith was a young defenseman on our team, and he has left us far too early as well. He was a second round pick. We didn't have a first rounder. He was as confident a young man as you could possibly get. He had all the answers. And so back then, so there was no toll transponder, right? Back then you bought a sticker and put it on your back window. And if you had a sticker, the toll was reduced to 25 cents from 75 cents. And so we had him in training camp and we carpool over. And so what we do is we drive through with the young guys and I'd open the window and I'd say, I'm with the Flyers. And then I'd throw the quarter in. And then he didn't know there was a sticker on the window. So he said, well, what's up with that? And I said, well, when you're with the Flyers or the Phillies or the Sixers or the Eagles, you get a discount on the tolls. You just have to tell them who you are. And so there was back then, you know, so this is an unmanned toll booth and it had what looked like a speaker in the middle of it. And so I said, you have to lean into that speaker and you have to yell really loud that you're with the Flyers. And you throw the quarter in and the gate goes up. So somebody is with him one day and he's going through and he gets, you know, he gets up and he says to the guy, watch this. And puts the window down and yells into a speaker. It's not a speaker, first of all. And he's yelling, I'm with the Flyers, so is the quarter. Well, of course, the gate doesn't go up.
Right.
And now he starts honking and he's yelling. So this guy comes out of the toll booth. I think it was a lady actually came out of the toll booth next to him and said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm with the Flyers. And she said, I don't care if you're with the Flyers. He said, but I get a discount. He's like, you don't get any discount with the Flyers. So we were. It worked pretty well. I guess you could pull it off today with the transponder,
right.
You know, with the iPass and the, you know, the Easy Pass. But we got him pretty good that day, and it was so much fun because he never lived it down.
Right,
you know, we'd be walking by him in the locker room, and you'd yell at him with the Flyers. And yeah, just
he knew exactly what it was.
Yeah. One of the perks of being a pro athlete.
No,
that's a
sure.
great. That's I hadn't thought of that in years. Thanks for bringing that up. Actually, that's a good. That's a funny Smitty story.
Yeah, no, I mean,
you've got good sources, Chris.
Thank you. I, you know, I'm curious. Now, this question's a little not as, I guess, fun. The Christmas Eve skate from Mike Keenan. How did that all go down? That wasn't supposed to be a bag skate, I don't think.
No, well, it was so impactful that I had a Christmas lunch on Friday with my golf buddies.
Mm-hmm.
And actually there were a handful of former players in that are regular golf friends of mine Mark Osborne, who played for the Rangers, Mark Napier, who played for Edmonton and Montreal, Mike Pellick, who played for the Leafs. So they were at, and they hadn't heard this story. And it's funny when you all get together, Chris, because you don't go into a Christmas lunch thinking you're going to tell a story, but something happens and something comes up, and then it, you know, it triggers in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 84, 85, Mike Keenan's first year, and we were really good. We had a great start to the year. And this, about 3 weeks before Christmas, the guys are looking at the schedule. And back then, now you have 3 full days off, the 24th, the 25th, and 26th. You can't skate by the CBA. Mm-hmm. But back then, you could skate both Christmas Eve and Boxing Day, or the 26th. And so we looked at our schedule, and some of the young guys from Toronto started asking me about 3 or 4 weeks before Christmas, you know, because Mike would print out the schedule for the month at the start of the month. So early December, we get the schedule for December, and it shows a Christmas Eve skate, I think at 11 a.m. And we were playing at home on the 23rd. And so the guys say to me as captain, you know, can you go to him and ask if we can get the skate moved up so we could fly home? And they found like an 11 a.m. flight. So we thought, okay, if we skate at 8 a.m., Mike always had short, crisp practices. It'll be done at 8:45, 9 o'clock, rush to the airport, get home, get a day and a half at home, and get back for our Boxing Day or 26th game. Boxing Day is a Canadian term, by the way. It's the day after mm-hmm. Christmas. Mm-hmm. And so so I go to Mike and I say, okay, you know, here's the situation. And he looks at me and he says, just keep winning. That's all he said. So now I go back to the guys and said, okay, so go ahead and make your plans. We'll keep winning and we'll get that skate moved up to 8 a.m. So everything falls in line perfectly. We win our games. They make their plans. And we come out for the 8 a.m. skate. And we have a great practice, Chris, like a great practice.
Yeah.
So about 8:30, Mike is winding up practice. And we had this 12-minute aerobic skate. And it'd be 1 minute each way, six times one way, six times the other way. And at the end of each minute, he'd blow the whistle. You'd hoot and holler, go the other way. But it was aerobic, long strides. He brings a big music boombox out. He puts Christmas carols on. He's blaring Christmas carols. Guys are flying, Chris. Like, forget aerobic. It's anaerobic. Mm-hmm. Like, guys are sprinting. Guys are flying. Like, we're going home for Christmas, you know. Now, these are 19 and 20 year olds. They're going home for the first time at Christmas as a NHL player.
Right.
At the end of it, Mike calls everybody together at 8:45. He lines us up on the goal line, and we skated for another 45 minutes. And it was the scene out of The Miracle with Herb Brooks.
Yeah.
It was blue line, red line, blue line, down and back. Guys are sick. Guys are throwing up. Guys are cramping. Guys are screaming at Mike. They're calling him names. They're cursing at him. They're so mad.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just standing at center ice, blowing the whistle. And I mean, the anger you felt, the ridiculousness of the situation, I had arranged that morning to have beer and pizza brought to the locker room for the guys that were staying, like, because that's what you do at 8:30 on Christmas Eve in the morning, right, is have a beer and have a piece of pizza.
Right.
And at the end, he called everybody together, and he's still got the Christmas carols going. Guys are furious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Santa Claus is coming.
Wait, so you are getting bag skated and the big boom box is just bumping.
Oh, yeah. Oh, just pumping Christmas carols. And so it was just, you know, it was so angry. Like, guys were so mad at the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
And he called everybody together at the end, and he simply said, expect the unexpected, and have a Merry Christmas. But what he wanted was, he wanted guys going home, telling that story and thinking about him and knowing that they were coming back. He didn't want them going home, celebrating life in the NHL. And the guys were miserable. And, you know, they rushed home and rushed back. And we went out the day after Christmas and we lost like 6-0 to Washington. And guys were cramping. Guys could, you know, it was it. But then we got it back together, went on a little roll, you know, won some games. I think we were going west. We beat LA. I remember beating the Edmonton a couple of days after Christmas, or after New Year's rather. Mm-hmm. And it just being, you know, like somehow he won.
Right.
But that was Mike. Mike was expect the unexpected. He wanted to keep you on edge. He wanted to keep you on guard. He never wanted you comfortable, which I disagreed with. I was a captain. A lot of the spirit fell to me, but it was effective and that he got a lot out of the players he had.
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like there's probably some guys that maybe, I guess, still are maybe a little upset at how you know they were, I guess, coached by Mike, or maybe the way that he coached. How do you, Dave Poulin, like when you look back on it, how do you kind of feel about Mike Keenan in the few years that you were here?
He got the most out of what he had, Chris. If the job of a coach is to get the most out of each individual player, I would argue Mike did that. Now, his methods, he probably lost a couple of guys. And he lost a young Scott Mellenby, for sure. And yet Scott Mellenby played 19 years in the NHL, mm-hmm. or 18 years in the NHL. So, you know, Mike would argue that he got Scott Mellenby. He might not have transformed him early, but there were some guys that couldn't handle it. The reason we were able to was our tightness as a group. It was Mark Howe. It was Brad McCrimmon. It was Tim Kerr. It was a young Rick Tocchet. Brad Marsh was a huge, huge part of the equation in terms of keeping things together. And even an offbeat, aloof Ilkka Sinisalo was. Lindsey Carson. I mean, to a man, the Sutter twins, Murray Craven. Murray Craven was as cerebral a person and hockey player as I've met.
Mm.
And so it had these different components and ingredients of personalities that somehow the grouping of us, the farmer and Brad McCrimmon, the proud Western Canadian Murray Craven, the college captain, in each individual, somehow the ingredients were put together that were able to handle that coach.
Going off that, after you played with the Flyers, you were in Boston. You ended up playing with Brian Propp there, and I'm not sure if you know this, but I got another note from someone on it that basically when you went to Boston and you guys went to the Stanley Cup Finals in 1990 against Edmonton, you were with Brian Propp. A lot of the Flyers fans were rooting for Boston and you two guys to end up winning. This is honestly probably like a two-part question, but how important was Brian Propp to you in your career? And do you think he's one of the few guys that aren't in the Hockey Hall of Fame that should be in the Hockey Hall of Fame now?
Okay, so first part of the question, he was a huge, huge part of my career. Mm-hmm. He was such an offensive player, yet he had defensive capabilities. I was so comfortable killing penalties with Brian Propp. I mean, we knew where each other were all the time. And, it translated into on-ice play. And he was a huge part of our run in Boston. We picked him up as well. Right on the edge of Hall of Fame for me. And I think Tim Kerr is there too.
Mm-hmm.
You look for, there's different factors with the Hall of Fame. And you look for the best at their position. Was Brian the best? And, I believe he was the first team All-Star left wing. So that year he was the best left wing. But he did a lot of things well. But did he do one thing well enough to be a Hall of Famer? Like Timmy might have. Timmy still has a power play record with 34 power play goals. And he went through, four consecutive seasons there. What, 58, 54, 54, 58, or in that configuration.
Right.
I get asked about both guys. And I think both, they'll pull up other guys that are in the Hall of Fame and say, well, compare Brian to Adino Cicerelli or something, how does it fit? And you don't know if winning a Stanley Cup might have put them over the edge.
Right.
And might have put them, they very well might have. And so I think it's an argument, but it is an argument. It's not a clear decision.
Right.
Like it's a barstool argument about whether they were Hall of Famers. And, the whole cup thing. We were in a golf tournament the year Ray Bourque won his cup in Colorado. And so early 2000s, we were in a cup golf tournament on the East Coast in Cape Cod. And there were a bunch of NHL players there. And they put a graphic up, and Ray Bourque had played the most playoff games without winning a cup at that point.
Right.
And whatever that number was at that point. And so, in other words, if he were to win the cup, he was going off the list.
Right.
And I believe at that time, I might be a little bit off here, but like number 2, number 5, and number 7 were all sitting at the bar. And then Proppy was one of them, and I was one of them, and Russ Courtneau from Montreal was one of them. So, like, we toasted Ray and said, if you win the cup, we're moving up, because all of us were retired. So Propper would still be in that list. He went to the finals twice more than I did. Mm-hmm. So he went to the finals 5 times without winning the cup.
Yeah. And it's such a shame, because I, you know, today in today's game, and obviously, like, you're in media now, and, like, you see it a lot with fans, and, like, they kind of, like, get on guys for not winning a cup. But it's such a hard journey and a hard thing to do that, you know, I personally don't do it. I honestly would kind of, if I were a player, I think I'd honestly kind of take a little bit, like, kind of, like, disrespectful, because, you know, you played so long and you played through a lot, you know, to be healthy and you know, all that stuff. And you know, that's kind of just part of how the game is now. But go ahead, sorry.
Well, you know, I went to the finals 3 times and the conference finals 6 times.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a player named Ron Hainsey. And, like, look at those numbers of Ron Hainsey. I believe he played, I don't even know, like 900 NHL games.
Yeah.
Before he played a playoff game.
Mm-hmm.
Before he played one playoff game. And so Pittsburgh trades for him. A couple guys get hurt. He gets elevated to the lineup. The first time he goes to the Stanley Cup playoffs, he wins a cup.
Yep.
And now he's a Stanley Cup winner. Mm-hmm. And I can remember when Toronto signed him after that. It was like, we're traded for a cup winner. And so you kind of laugh and you're like, well, he played 20 playoff games in his career. Mm-hmm. You know, I played 130 playoff games in my career. So
right place, went to the right team at the right time. Exactly.
Yeah, yep. It's part of it, though, Chris. It's life, mm-hmm. right? And it's the way it goes. And, you know, he had a lot of miserable years where he sat at home and watched me in the playoffs, you know, and wishes he was there. And
right.
Had we left something on the table, particularly, well, all 3 years I went in 85 and 87 with the Flyers, 90 with the Bruins. If I felt like I had not given what I had, or my teammates had given what they had, it would have been much harder.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like we left what we had out in the ice. You look at those Oilers teams. Well, are there? There's at least 7. Are there 8 of those guys in the Hall of Fame? We had one. We had Mark Howe.
Yeah. Pretty much every year the Flyers lost in the Cup final. I ran into a dynasty from the Islanders in the early '80s. The Oilers, even in 2010 with Chicago. I mean,
you're exactly right.
Year and the Red Wings as well.
In Detroit. Yeah.
Detroit. Mm-hmm.
You could argue that that's a great point, that those losses are all to dynastic teams in mm-hmm. those years. So that's a great point.
Yeah. And that's kind of the unfortunate thing of it is, you know, I think they have 10 finals appearances and, you know, only 2 wins, but you know, they've unfortunately ran into every dynasty you could think of. And kind of going back to 1987, you mentioned a little bit, you won the Selke that year with the Flyers. I believe that's the only Selke you've won. You were runner up in, I think it was 92-93 with Boston. What was that like, you know, kind of winning the Selke, and then you played in Rendezvous 87 that year. How was all that for that season?
Yeah.
For
you? So start with Rendezvous, because that preceded the Selke.
Mm-hmm.
That was totally unexpected. They were picking one all-star team from the NHL to play against the Russian Red Army team. And so no all-star game that year, 2 games against the Russian Red Army during the Quebec Winter Carnival. Never been tried before in that exact format. And there's no way I'm making that team. Like, that's not even on my radar screen. I'd been to the all-star game in 86, but I'm not thinking I'm on that team. And I got a call late to say that, you know, I was going to be invited to Quebec. I couldn't believe it. And so when we got up to Quebec, they called 3 of us together. It was Kevin Dineen from Hartford, myself, and the great, great Dale Howardchuk, who left us way too early as well. And they called us together and said, listen, we're going to play you as a line, Dave. We're going to move you to left wing. And we're going to play you against the great KLM line, which was Krutov, Larionov, and Makarov. And the 2 defensemen, Fetisov and Kasatanov. Now, those guys, Chris, had been put together when they were 10 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. And they were now 28 years old.
Yeah.
I could have played together for 18 years. Larionov was 12 at the time there. He was 12. Yeah. The other four were 10. Other way around. They were 12.
He was
Larionov
10.
Was 10. Mm. Right. Crazy, crazy. Like 16 yeah. years playing as a five-some.
That's insane.
And
that's so a lot of NHL talent, too.
Oh, huge. So I'm looking at Kevin. I'm saying, okay, I know why we're here. Why Dale Hawerchuk? And one of the coaches laughed. He said, if you actually do get the puck away from them, Dale is the best puck possession guy we have. So that's the way we'll keep it. And we had a great series. We scored two goals in the first game and shut down that line. And as great as Dale Hawerchuk was, the Hall of Famer, he was better than that. I couldn't believe how good this guy was.
Mm-hmm.
He just to play with him and to see how he controlled the puck and possessed. And, you know, I was able to get the winning goal in the first game on a tip in late in the game. And then we, again, in the second game, scored again and shut down that line. And I think that was the prelude to winning the Selke. Because, you know, when I got back, Brad Marsh said to me, and our next game was in St. Louis, and I scored a couple goals that night. And he said, you know, your exposure in Rendezvous is going to win you the Selke as the best defensive forward. Because you were there for defensive reasons. And you've taken your recognition to another level, and he was correct.
Mm. So this one right here is probably my last question. You coached a little bit as well at Notre Dame, and you're also athletic director. What were some of your favorite moments in your coaching career?
You know what? I coached for 10 years. It was an unexpected call that brought me back to Notre Dame, my alma mater.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really. I'd never thought of coaching. I wasn't going to stay in hockey in any capacity. Mm. I was going to join the business world, and I sort of set things up on that front. The call came from Notre Dame to come back, and we thought, what a perfect place to raise my daughters and three daughters. And it was a perfect place to raise them. But I'm not sure I was ever cut out to be a coach. Mm. I did it for 10 years. The kids that I coached, that's the memory. It's the guys I stay in touch with. Over the years, a number of them are in hockey now, and a handful of them do coach, are coaching at the various levels. And so that's the relationships I made and the people I met at Notre Dame. And then getting the program back on track, it had been through some really tough times. Jeff Jackson came in when I was done and has done a magnificent job with the program. We were able to get a new building built early in his tenure. And that was part of me staying in the athletic director's role. And now Notre Dame hockey is a perennial top 20 team.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest facilities in college.
Yeah, it's hockey. A huge hockey school.
Yeah, and that's proud. That's proud for me to be able to have been a part of that.
Right. No, for sure. Dave, seriously, thank you so much for doing this. I really do appreciate it. You mentioned that you're in media and all that stuff. Is there anything that you have coming up that you could maybe want to tell some Flyers fans about?
Yeah, you know, I'll be back in Philadelphia. I've got there a couple times this year, and I enjoy coming in immensely and seeing Flyer fans. And mm-hmm. I do get back, and I guess be patient as hard as it is right now.
Yeah,
and I referenced you look back at the past, but you have to look to the future. And, you know, you've got some bright young players on the team, and you've got to look and support them and be part of the groundswell, be part of as they start to get good and, you know, as they find their feet. And I've got some key injuries now, I know that, but be part of the next generation of great Flyer fans, because ours were great. Mm-hmm. The 70s were great, you know, the 90s into the 2000s, each generation has their own team. Right. This is your team, embrace your team. And enjoy it and know that there's pain involved, but there's great things involved as well.
Right. That's awesome. Dave Pullen, everybody. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it.
All right. There he is, Dave Pullen. That was awesome. That was honestly one of my favorite interviews that I've honestly ever done. Yes, Ryan, that is very true. The Oilers teams were insane. Very true. And again, we hinted at that a little bit, right? I mean, every team that the Flyers ran into in the, you know, years that they've made the Cup final has been a dynasty. We mentioned the teams there, but again, kind of moving present. And you know, I think a lot of what Dave said, it is right, because a lot of what we have to do up until now, people like this, I got a call coming in. Go ahead, Dad.
Great interview, dude. Loved it.
Thanks, Dad.
Loved it. The only thing I'm a little disappointed in is that you didn't say the Red Wings dynasty first, but I'm going to let you slide on that.
It's all right. Well, the Red Wings were later, though. They were later on. That was before.
But you said Chicago before.
I forgot. I corrected myself.
All right.
It's all right. Go ahead.
All they had to do was sign for Brendan Shanahan. Remember that.
Yeah, that is true.
I'll say that to my dying day. All right, quick question for tonight's game.
Mm-hmm.
You, the Hart not being in net and the Avs being so beat up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I would have personally had Hart in net. Obviously, the better one between the pipes.
Mm-hmm.
To maybe try to get a W to, you know, give them something to build on.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts? I'll let you go. Peace.
All right. Bye.
Love you.
Love you. Bye. Let's find out, everybody. Yeah. So Hart. Well, he's started the last 7, and this will be 18 days since Sandstrom has played. Today is 18. So, yeah, I think it's okay for Sandstrom to get a game. I thought he should have started against Arizona. And you know, kind of going off of that, you know, guys like Sandstrom, guys like Frost, guys like Tippett, guys like Cates, guys like Cam York, you know, this is the group. I mean, there's really no getting around it now. I mean, this is what the Flyers are. And at this point, I mean, I'm kind of over the whole, I guess the constant moaning and complaining about, you know, what the team didn't do and this and that and the other. I'm more towards looking forward and looking towards, you know, what the Flyers can kind of build on. You know, and again, look, that doesn't mean I'm not going to criticize, and that doesn't mean I'm not going to, that doesn't mean I'm just going to be oblivious to all the things that are wrong either. But I do think, you know, part of it is moving on. And I think a lot of that, you know, can kind of, you know, people don't really want to hear that, you know, it's more of, nobody has any patience, and I don't really blame anybody because they've struggled. And, you know, I think a lot of people have kind of dropped off with them, and, you know, there hasn't been as much, I guess, love towards the team. And there's been a lot of, I mean, again, this is nothing new. Everybody watching this knows it. Everyone sees it. You know, it's nothing crazy what I'm saying here. This is all, you know, normal things, and that's the unfortunate part. But I think a lot of what I liked about Dave too was that he remembered so much in the sense of like little things, like the example on Craig Smith, like basically saying the Flyers didn't have a first rounder that year. You know, knowing how many games they were up in the series in 85, when he scored the shorthanded goal against the Nordiques, like little things like that, that, you know, certain things that they remember, obviously the big moments. But it was crazy how, like, the little stuff, like, it's crazy to me how a former captain remembers the Flyers didn't even have a pick, you know, the 1 year that they ended up taking Greg Smith, the defenseman. So, you know, and part of that is because he, you know, he works in media and all the other stuff too, but again, it was really good. Dave, thanks so much for tuning in, or not tuning in, but coming on. That was just really, really fun. It really was. But moving on to the task at hand tonight, the Flyers at 9 o'clock Eastern time. We have a little hashtag Flyers After Dark, which is usually a regular Twitter thing. Flyers are taking on the Colorado Avalanche, and they last beat the Avs on December 5th, 5-3 in Philadelphia. That was a entertaining game, I guess. I thought there were some good things in that game for the Flyers. Obviously, A, because they got 2 points and they won. They scored more goals than the other team. That's very important. And B, you know, they, besides the almost epic collapse towards the end of it, they actually played pretty well for, you know, 56 something minutes of that game. They didn't have a great start. The Avs are really missing some guys. I'll get into the lines for both teams in a minute, but you know, again, you're moving through this type of stretch, and these last two games for the Flyers, you had Arizona Sunday night, another winnable game that the Flyers let slip by. And that's been kind of the unfortunate part of all this, too, is that there has been certain games that they have let slip. Arizona was one. And, you know, when you look at Arizona, that was a game where you, again, were up at one point, played bad for a handful of minutes, then dominated, didn't even have that great of a start. You were down 1-0. And then you ended up coming back in the final minute. And in overtime, you again had the puck for majority of the overtime. And when you didn't, Ristolainen decided to dump it in 3-on-3 overtime when possession is key. Everybody knows this. It's been put in 2000, I think it was 2015, 16. Yeah, that sounds about right. It was that season. And the Flyers lost the first ever game in 3-on-3 overtime too. So there's that. But again, dumping the puck in that, I mean, on my, and it's crazy to even hear myself say that, because you lose the first ever game in 3-on-3 overtime against Tampa Bay. It was that goal from Jason Garrison that one year. And I know my dad's going to be busting on me for just remembering that, but that, and then the shootouts, and that, I think using the two defensemen in the shootout is more because they play for the shootout. And why? Like, why are you playing for the shootout? You're historically like one of the worst teams in the shootout. You had one shootout goal last year. One. And this year, I don't know if they have any shootout goals this year. They might have one or two. But I don't know about that. I don't really remember. There's only been a handful of games that have kind of gone to a shootout. But again, for overtime, they're 0-6 in overtime already. And towards, you know, he's like, we have to figure out the overtime period. Why are you using two defensemen? Like, if this game were to go to overtime tonight, the Avs, they don't have as much, right? Again, if we're looking at lines, we'll start with Colorado, then we'll move on to the Flyers. Avs, lines for tonight, this is per Adrian Dater of Colorado Hockey Now. Again, this is from the Avs Morning Skate. Lehkonen, Rantanen, Nichushkin, Cogliano, Compher, and O'Connor, Hudon, Myers, and Foodie, Hunt, Newhook, and McDonald, Gerard, and McCarr, Taze, and Johnson, Hunt, and Englin on defense, and then Pavel Francouz is a net for Colorado. Yes, Ryan, they are. They're literally one of the worst shootout teams ever. The Flyers, on the other hand, you have Van Riemsdyk with Frost and Tippett, so that line stays together. Hayes with Cates and Konechny, Sedlak with Lawton and McEwen, Delorier with Brown and Farabee, Provorov and Ristolainen, Sanheim and York, Sealer and Braun. No Tony D'Angelo. Unfortunately, his grandmother passed away. So again, thoughts and prayers there with Tony and the D'Angelo family. Felix Sandstrom gets the nod tonight for the Flyers. Carter Hart will be back it up again. I mentioned the last 7 games Carter Hart started, and first game in 18 days for Sandstrom. So he's going to be a little bit of rusty. The Avs are going with the hot hand in Francouz. Again, no McKinnon. They're missing majority of their players for the Avs. Again, their top six is just again, top six alone. Lehkonen, Rantanen, Chushkin, Cogliano, Confer, and O'Connor. That's completely different than what the Avs' usual top six is looking like. They're missing majority of their forwards, majority of their players, and they have been off to a kind of a not really a great start. They're injured, and right now they are in fourth in the Central. They're 14-10-2 with 30 points. They're only 2 points behind third. The Jets and Stars are tied in the Central with 37 points, and the Jets have 2 games in hand on the Stars, but are, you know, 2 games behind. But again, games in hand don't really mean much unless you actually win. Flyers are in 7th in the Metropolitan Division, 29 games played, 9-13-7, 25 points, and they are slipping and slipping from the bottom. But again, if you're looking towards the wild card standings, again, I mentioned this on the last podcast as well, on the last episode of episode 20, depending on if anyone is actually, I guess, looking at the Flyers to really even make the playoffs this season, even though it's probably not in the best bets to do that, or really anything like that. For some reason, NHL.com is deciding to be very slow as I'm looking at this. But again, making the playoffs this year really isn't the best thing for the Flyers right now. They have 25 points. Islanders are in second in the wild card with 34. So they're starting to drop and drop and drop. And again, making the playoffs really doesn't bode well for the Flyers this year. I'm not going to root for them to lose. That's not something I do. But with the way that this draft looks right now, it's going to be very, I guess, exciting because you have a chance to get a really high pick. Last game, you know, even though the Flyers did lose in overtime, one of the better things was the Frost line. Vanerzik with Frost and Tippett. Again, I'm very excited to see how that worked out. The Flyers have it again as slated as a top line tonight. So that's going to be something that's going to have to kind of hopefully continue. Morgan Frost with a 4-point game, a goal and 3 assists. That line combined for 11 points last game. And you know, these plays for Frost, you know, the goal was more of like just like a tap in at the side of the net. But you know, it's not like he wasn't setting up anybody or having like legit chances to score or anything like that. Like he was, again, had a handful of nice passes. The setup for Konechny was beautiful on the tying goal, the 4-4 goal late in the third. So again, that's the stuff that you want to build on. You know, it was definitely exciting to see something like that for Frost, because again, he's had the chances, he's had the looks, and you know, Konechny said it post game, and you know, he definitely, I'm sure, is confident after that. So again, we're getting closer to the holidays as well. As you've noticed, I broke out the Santa hat. I actually had a Adirondack Phantoms, like I think they're called ski hats. I don't really know. They have they kind of go over the ear and then they like flip up here. It's kind of weird, but I had one of those for a handful of years, and I was trying to find it before we started, but I ended up, I wasn't able to. But we broke out the Santa hat for the holidays, and yeah, Flyers are taking on the Avalanche tonight at 9 o'clock. Some late night hockey. I'm already tired, so this is going to be great. Staying up till 12:30, 1 o'clock to watch the Flyers. Yeah, again, Flyers Avs tonight. Again, thanks everybody so much. Dave Pullen was great. We had 17 people in here at one point, which is great because we've been averaging around that a little bit more. Also, the sub count has gone up as well. And one other thing I wanted to mention before we hopped off, two things actually. We have the trivia question. This is a good one. And again, this is obviously Dave Pullen themed. How many hat tricks did Dave Pullen score in his career as a Flyer? I'm curious if anybody in the comments. I know Ryan, if he's still in here, I know he's very good at this stuff. I've seen him on Twitter with a handful of questions and stuff like that. Let's see if anybody gets it. If not, I'll give the answer anyway. 5. He's got 5 hat tricks in his career against with the Flyers. Again, do the trivia every week. Always like doing that stuff. And also, quick little update for myself. Probably saw it on Twitter. I joined Philly Hockey Now with Sam Carcitti, Russ Cohen, and Ariel Melendez. We all are now part of Philly Hockey Now. I'm going to be doing some video content, some other stuff for then. And also, every Friday morning, I'll be having my columns for Philly Hockey Now as well. So check out all that. Again, check out Philly Hockey Now on Twitter as well. Follow them because they have a lot of cool stuff. And, you know, I'm very excited for this. This is going to be really cool. I mean, Sam is a guy that I grew up reading all of that stuff. And ever since I kind of wanted to get into media and all that stuff too, he's been a huge help for me. And same with, you know, Bill Meltzer, Jordan Hall, Jason Mertedis, so many others as well. But yeah, again, very excited for this. It's kind of like another step in the right direction, I guess, for me. So again, I really couldn't thank all of you enough, everybody on here, for all of the support, for kind of getting me to this point, because again, I wouldn't be here without any of you watching. So I really, really do appreciate that. And yeah, thanks everybody so much. Also a quick little tidbit, I guess, a little sneak peek to episode 22. The former announcer for NBC Sports, the Wednesday night, or what was that called? The Wednesday night rivalry. I completely drew a blank. Former announcer started with the Flyers, was with the Devils for a little bit, did the Stanley Cup Finals up until 2020. Doc Emmerich, Mike Doc Emmerich, will be joining me for episode 22. So stay tuned for that, because that's going to be a great interview. Actually, recording that tomorrow. So again, it'll be similar to Pool and it'll be recorded. And unfortunately, it's audio only, so there won't be any camera or anything like that, which takes a little bit away from it. But I know the people on audio and stuff, it doesn't really matter. But again, do apologize about that. But yeah, very, very excited for that. So stay tuned for episode 22 with Mike Emmerich, or Doc Emmerich, I should say. But yeah, Flyers take on the Avalanche tonight at 9 o'clock. Stay tuned for the game review. Again, we've been getting up. We've been getting out there with the subs as well. We gained 3 from the last episode. We're 1,455 away from we're out of that counter of 2,000. So again, for SeatGeek, use code Flyers Animated for $20 off the purchase of tickets over $50. Again, so that's a great deal for SeatGeek. Get some good tickets and save yourself $20. But yeah, again, thanks everybody so much. Always appreciate all the support as always. And I will see you all guys tonight for the game review. And yeah, stay tuned for episode 22 of the show next week. Thanks, you guys. Talk to you all again soon.